Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast.
Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know?
My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. When the Beatles last recorded together in August 1969, it was a dream that they would make one more record together. Imagine a parallel universe where, a little over 2.5 years later, John, Paul, George and Ringo got back together one more time on vinyl. Well, it did happen. It just wasn't a Beatles record. It was Ringo's album, Ringo, which came out at the end of 1973. And that's the record that we're going to focus in and look at today. How did it come to pass? And how does it stand up all these years later? Listen, broadly speaking, Stephen, I'm a fan of this record. It's a gem.
I'm a huge fan of this record. I love this record.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and it holds up. It really encapsulates all the things that we know and love about Ringo. So let's have a look, because it's an interesting. It comes at an interesting time. In some ways, it feels like a debut album for Ringo. It's not a debut album. He put out two albums in 1970.
Yes.
Which are Sentimental Journey and Beaucoup of Blues.
Yeah. So those are really, if you like, I suppose, vanity projects. You know, we're used these days to rock stars putting out their album of standards or their, you know, hip hop album or their Irish folk music album. But this was Ringo had put these two albums out. He really, I don't think, counts them as part of his canon or part of his catalog. You know, I think he very much regards Ringo as being his debut album, and certainly that's the way to approach it. I think he has two excellent singles. Then he sort of puts the recording career to one side, focuses on film, and then takes his time getting around to recording this. You know, it's I don't know how thought out it was, but he was clearly not wanting to rush into competition with the other three.
And it's interesting because, you know, it's a lifetime in at that time, the 3 years he spends, you know, two albums in 1970 and then a 3 year gap until Ringo comes out. Yeah. And in that time, you know, John's putting out Imagine and George is putting out All Things Must Pass and Paul is putting out loads of records and eventually getting to eventually reaching that Band in the Run place. And, you know, people probably weren't waiting for the big Ringo solo statement. And it wasn't like he wasn't busy. He was quite busy in 71, 72, 73.
He was. His focus was simply not recording an album. He was working on films. So there's a list of films, Blind Man, That'll Be the Day, 200 Motels, which is the Frank Zappa film, Son of Dracula, which we'll maybe touch on at some point in the future.
The films of Ringo Starr.
Films of Ringo Starr, Born to Boogie. So he was hanging out with Mark Bolan. He was making a documentary. He also had a furniture business, Ringo or Robin. Where this, from what I can know about this, it seems largely to be engraving the Apple logo on bits of furniture and selling it for vastly inflated sums. But
are you going to tell me that some of this furniture goes for insane amounts of money these days? Do we have any documentary evidence of Ringo or Robin furniture that seems like the kind of thing that would pop up in some sort of vanity auction these days?
Yeah, well, welcome to my living room.
Oh, I see.
no, it's. I've seen descriptions of things which are sort of photographs of sort of polished chrome ashtrays, and they famously made an etched mirror for Harry Nilsson for Harry Nilsson's bathroom. Except what they did was they etched a noose on the mirror so that when he was shaving, his head appeared to be in a noose. Even Harry Nilsson drew the line at that and had it removed. But so he's throwing himself into other projects other than mainstream rock projects.
Yes. And something that's kind of happening in the background that's worth keeping in mind, because it kind of infuses itself into the Ringo album, is this maybe you might call a rock and roll revivalism, or people are starting to kind of, you know, put things to, you know, they look back to what was happening in the mid-50s. These guys were all in their 30s and they felt they were over the hill, you know?
Exactly. I mean, this is this first wave of nostalgia for that first flush of rock and roll. So I suppose the group that I always think of is Sha Na Na and their weird rock and roll revival routine in 1969 at Woodstock. And then, of course, Lennon appears at the Toronto Rock and Roll Festival. So again, in the early 70s, you know, I'm old enough to remember Bill Haley having a hit single, a moment, Chuck Berry was back in the charts. So yeah, there was a sort of nostalgia for that first flush of rock and roll. And certainly, you know, you had American Graffiti, you had Happy Days coming along. That early to mid 70s period was very nostalgic.
Yeah, Sha Na Na, man, that just sent shivers down the spine. I went down a Sha Na Na rabbit hole one day on YouTube, because they're regularly mocked on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast. And, they're really unfathomable, Sha Na Na.
Yeah, I think if anybody out there hasn't seen them, their gold lame suited appearance at Woodstock is something to behold.
Yes, they make the UK's darts seem like, I don't know, Little Richard. It's quite extraordinary. Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to the topic on hand, because the Ringo album is an album from 1973, and the bulk of it's recorded March and April 73, and it comes out at the end of 73. And it's coming out in the context of, we have had some Ringo singles before that, haven't we? We've had, which ones have we had?
Yes, so you have It Don't Come Easy.
Yeah.
Back Off Boogaloo. The interesting thing to me is both of those songs are essentially co-writes between Ringo and George.
Yeah.
So although George doesn't get an official credit on It Don't Come Easy, I think everyone is pretty clear that George is one of the prime movers there. He deserves a writing credit.
Yes, yeah. And so it's kind of sending a template for Ringo getting helped by a fellow fab.
Yes, and this is really sets the tone for that the Ringo album itself. And there's another Harrison collaboration there, which provides another single. And it's really tempting to speculate what that writing partnership might have been like if they had persisted. You know, between them, you know, they have four or five, six top 10 US UK singles during this period, three number one singles, I think. Coming out of that partnership, all the way back to Octopus's Garden is effectively a co-write. So, you know, it's that collaboration with George, I think, is very important. And
That George Ringo thing, it is an interesting axis that, you know, George brings melody into Ringo's world quite heavily. And you could argue that, you know, Ringo brings a certain kind of levity, or, you know, a change of tone to George's lyrical bent, you know?
Yes, I mean, even I would admit George can be slightly serious, and I think they work extremely well together.
Yeah, and they were both in the Beatles, I believe, so that's a good thing.
So they the common background, shared background.
So when we try and look at, you know, when this project kind of starts, you might be looking back to, you know, the start of March, and on the 3rd of March, 1973, Harry Nilsson and Ringo are presenters at the Grammy Awards in LA, isn't that right?
That's right. And this seems to have been something that was organized or set up by Richard Perry, who is a record producer. He's probably most famous before the Ringo album for producing Carly Simon's No Secrets album in 1972. But he had worked with Ringo back in 1970 as an arranger on Sentimental Journey.
Yeah.
He puts forward this notion to the organizers of the Grammys. Hey, it would be great to get Ringo and Harry to present something. Harry Nilsson was nominated for a Grammy that year.
Well, he was nominated for Nilsson Schmilsson, which is also a Richard Perry production. So he had done this thing for Nilsson where he had taken this kind of mercurial talent and yep. fashioned something very, I wouldn't call Nielsen Schmielsen a sensible album, but it certainly got a saleable quality to it, and it gets to the essence of Nielsen.
Yes, yes, and it's that connection that really drives forward is the initial impetus for Ringo.
Yeah,
and reading around it, you do get the sense that Richard Perry, he knew what he was doing. You know, he was very purposefully setting this up and putting himself in the producer's chair. Now, I do remember seeing the clip of Ringo and Harry Nilsson at the Grammys. It's no longer on YouTube, but these things go up and come down.
Yes.
But it's very funny. They come on, they do that sort of monkeys cross walk that the monkeys do down the beach at the start of their TV show, and they do a sort of two-handed skit, clearly enjoying each other's company. And
at each other's drinks cabinet, probably.
Yes, each other's drinks cabinet. They are clearly refreshed, yes.
And Richard Perry, somebody else who was in Richard Perry's orbit was Klaus Voormann, who plays the bass on Carly Simon's You're So Vain, the very famous kind of wobbly bass at the start. Yeah. And he's going to play a big role in what's about to happen. So 2 days later then, Ringo's in the studio with Harry Nilsson, being produced by Richard Perry, and they're laying down the first track of the album, which is You're 16. Now, was this, this wasn't totally off the back of the Grammys. This was obviously, this was kind of on the cards anyway.
This seems to have been on the cards. Richard Perry had sort of block booked a period of time at Sunset. Sound recorders in LA. And, you know, so you get the sense that Ringo's initial idea for this album was it was going to be a world album in the sense that he wanted
to record. Like Peter Gabriel. No.
not quite. But he wanted to record a track in London, record a track in New York, record a track in LA, you know, go off to, I don't know, Delhi or South Africa, or where, probably not South Africa, or wherever. I don't know if that was still on the cards at this stage, but clearly Richard Perry takes a punt, books the 5 days, let's see what happens. And I think the initial recording with Harry Nilsson on You're 16 goes so well that really sets things up and sets the tone for what to follow.
And it's, you know, you listen to that track, You're 16, which is the last track on side A of the album, and you know, you hear that it's Nilsson who is doing his Nilsson thing. That's what's really making that sound so sweet. Like, you listen to those backing vocals, and he's harmonizing with himself, which is one of Nilsson's great gifts, which was harmony and kind of close recording. There's a great clip of Nilsson on BBC TV special where he's singing with himself, you might have seen through the technology of the early 70s. But those vocal arrangements are spectacular.
It is. I mean, you know, the entire structure, the entire vocal structure there, it's almost more of a Nilsson track in the sense of the arrangement and the vocal, sort of the bed of the entire song is put together by Harry Nilsson.
And then the Cream of session people are there as well.
I was going to say, you also have the very sort of distinctive piano from Nicky Hopkins. You've got Bobby Keys, who played with the Stones, doing a sax solo. So, you know, Klaus Voormann is there. So it's, and one of the things that you get with, you have a same rotating cast of characters across Stones albums, you know, Harrison albums, Ringo's albums, Nilsson's albums. It's the same gang is kind of hanging out and playing across all of these early 70s albums.
Yeah, and it's as you say, Nicky Hopkins and Klaus Voormann are there. Nicky Hopkins had played on a Beatles track. He played on the Revolution B-side to Hey Jude. Yep. That's his piano piece, and he's all over many Stones records. And it's also maybe unbeknownst to Ringo, again, this recurring theme of old rock and roll. And, you know, the song comes out as the second single in 74 and gets to number one for a week. But there's a lot of other things happening in the ether. There's like the movie American Graffiti, isn't there? Because that's kind of happening at the end of 73.
Yes, and the original version of this song was recorded by Johnny Burnett in 1960, and it featured heavily in American Graffiti.
Yeah.
I don't think Ringo or Richard Perry could possibly have known that was coming when they were recording. You know, they're recording at the start of the year. American Graffiti comes out in August, but it was just a fantastic coincidence that undoubtedly helped propel Ringo's version to the
And if and something that may or may not still be on YouTube is a TV special from 1978 where he sings this song in a rather cheesy, terrible way with Carrie Fisher as the
yes,
the young love interest.
That has to be seen to be believed. It's it's, you know, hilarious and slightly slightly disturbing version of that song. It's clear. I think it's clear Carrie Fisher has no idea who Ringo Starr is, or why she is there, or possibly where she is.
That is that is possible by that state of time. So that's great. And then, you know, what we might do now is look at the next song that's recorded. And then from then on in, we'll probably look at the songs in order that they appear on the album, because the next song that is recorded is the opening track of the record, which is I'm the Greatest.
Yeah.
Written by...
John Lennon.
John Lennon of the Beatles again.
And yeah, again, the coincidence is amazing.
What are the chances? And so it seems that, you know, by that kind of second week in March, around the 10th of March, Lennon and Harrison are in Los Angeles. They've got business to attend to. They know that Ringo has started recording with Harry Nilsson. So they decide to just appear, more or less. It's reasonably casual.
I that certainly all the stories are that this is a reasonably casual meeting. George drops in initially, listens to what Ringo's got recorded for the first couple of days, says this is absolutely fantastic. Then John turns up with Yoko. One of the reasons he was in LA was also to promote Yoko's Approximately Infinite Universe.
Great album.
So Yoko is there. Sadly, doesn't make an appearance on Ringo, but still. She is on the cover, if you scan the crowd. John arrives. He's got a song, I'm the Greatest, which has a bit of a history. He'd written it back in 1971, presumably as a song that he was going to record himself. But he donates it to this project. And I think, certainly bearing in mind the title and the lyrics, it's probably best that he gave it to Ringo.
Yes. It's interesting because, you know, the song kind of opens the album and it kind of immediately plunges us into this, you know, nostalgia theme, you know, and it kind of plunges us into this kind of branding of Ringo as you know, what he is doing as his entertaining. You know, he's referring back to the Beatles. I was part of the greatest show on earth. He's talking about Billy Shears. You know, he's saying catastrophically that he's 32 and all he wants to do is boogaloo.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're listening, John and George are on it. You hear John singing along with them. And there is a mix from these sessions in the Lennon Anthology box set from the late 90s where you can hear John Lennon's take on the song as well. And then playing bass is Klaus Voormann. So all of a sudden you have this song, and this song has John, George and Ringo and their new bass player, Klaus. And it's the closest thing we have so far to a reunion. Now, this was rumored to be some kind of replacement band, but that's a bit of a myth, isn't it?
It is. It is. This supposedly this was a group called The Ladders.
Yeah.
And this is a myth that still persists today. And you can find lots of sort of, if you go on the internet, you can find made up set lists and track lists and things. But this goes back to an interview that Ringo gave in 1970 to Melody Maker, where he's being asked, you know, will they record together? And he says, I'll be in a group with John and George and Klaus, and we'll call it The Ladders or whatever you want to call it. But I don't think it would be called The Beatles. So it's a throwaway remark. You know, he could have used any name, but suddenly this becomes a rumor that The Ladders was going to be an actual group. I mean, certainly one of the things that comes out of this session is that George gets the notion that this would be a great group, and that he and John and Ringo should form a band. And John is very dismissive of this at the time, but particularly in 1980, in those sort of late 1980 interviews, he says, you know, this was really embarrassing, and George was sort of pestering me and kept asking, and, you know, it was a good session, but, you know, how could he ever think I would form a band? Now, bear in mind, in late 1980, John didn't have a particularly good relationship with George, but certainly there seems to have been a sense that something might have been possible. Certainly George was the one that seemed to be the prime mover there.
Well, there's a quote here from Richard Perry where he says, Just like that, no planning, the three ex-Beatles recorded one of John's songs. Everyone in the room was just gleaming. It's such a universal gleam with the Beatles. So obviously there's a frisson of excitement about the fact that these three are playing, and the kind of the rumour gets out. It's reported that the three of them are recording on this track. What I was trying to figure out, and maybe you don't know this off the top of your head, is this the last time John and George record together?
I think so. I mean, George and John would not meet again until December 1974.
Right.
Which was the sort of dark end of the Dark Horse tour, the dissolution papers that, and again, they didn't have a particularly good time there. And, you know, there are some meetings around 1974, but I think this is the last time the two of them recorded together.
Yeah, so it's interesting that, you know, there's all this talk that it's going to be the potential of a brand new dawn, and actually it's really the last time that you get John, George and Ringo together in a room playing music, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And this Lennon also said in a later interview that, you know, McCartney could have played on it, but he just wasn't in Los Angeles. He just wasn't around, or he wasn't allowed into, I think, the US at that time. I think his drug arrests were still playing havoc with that.
His one of many drug arrests was were preventing him getting access. Yeah.
So it's that's kind of a portentous opener. You know, Lennon goes back to New York after that, and the first news appears about a week later on the 17th of March that rumours, it says in the Melody Maker, rumours flash through Los Angeles that three of the Beatles have teamed up for recording purposes. So that's quite an exciting stamp to get things going.
Yes, that the headline for that article was Beatles to Record Again. So this was very much being put forward as a full-blown reunion. And one of the interesting things at this period is just how prevalent the Beatles were. You know, at this time, it's around this time, middle of March, that they Capitol announced the Red and Blue albums are coming down the line. They get released at the beginning of April. You have Nicky Hopkins comes out denying that it's a Beatles reunion. Klaus Voormann makes a statement saying, oh no, it's just they were there and, you know, it wasn't planned. It was just they were looking for something to do. So so there's this frantic downplaying by everyone involved that this is not a reunion, but it's seized upon particularly by the Melody Maker.
So let's move on to the next track on the album, which is called Have You Seen My Baby? It's written by Randy Newman. And Randy Newman, I suppose in 73, he's getting into the process of becoming known as Randy Newman. He's had this musician's existence and this songwriter's existence for a decade at that point, and he's forming his own solo identity. And this track originally comes from Randy Newman's second album, and he'd also done an arrangement and a version for Fats Domino. And also Randy Newman, there's another Nielsen overlap there, because Nielsen did his album of Randy Newman covers. But the interesting thing about this track is Mark Bolan is on it.
Yes.
There's no bigger star at that point, really, coming out in 1972 than Mark Bolan, in the UK anyway.
In the UK, I mean, certainly, you know, Bolan mania had he was regarded as, you know, it was comparable to Beatlemania.
Yeah.
Ringo was working with him, as I said earlier, on Born to Boogie, which is a documentary film. Bolan is recording the album The Slider at this particular time. He's working with Tony Visconti, who sort of works with Bowie, goes on. He is huge at this. I mean, he's dominating the singles charts around this time. So Ringo was very much sort of aligning himself with the up and coming trend.
It's always been an interesting relationship, the fact that Ringo and Mark Bolan were so close for such a, you know, specific period of time when Bolan was really blowing up. And that Ringo, a lot of people might know this, Ringo took the famous cover photo on the front of the Slider album, the T-Rex album, The Slider, that kind of slightly blurry, iconic photo of Mark Bolan in his top hat, you know?
Don't let Tony Visconti hear you say that.
Why? He doesn't think that's true, no?
He claims that he took that photograph.
Really?
He said, Mark gave me his camera, I took the photographs, but whatever Mark thought, having Ringo giving him the credit would you know, look be a better thing. So he's, yeah, I think Tony's a bit put out about that. So
we're not
going to get Tony on the show now.
and they were photos taken at Tittenhurst Park as well, that the rock and rollest of all mansions. So yeah, you listen to that song, and right at the start, you get a nice little you know, a little boogie guitar riff from Mark Bolan, you know,
and the solo in the middle could be by no one else.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just even if you didn't know that that's who it was, you would know who was playing. It's a very, very distinctive guitar sound.
And it's interesting because somebody else who was in that milieu at the time was Elton John. It's a wonder he's not on this Ringo album. He was probably too darn busy at the time, but he had been playing with Ringo and Mark the previous year as well, hadn't he?
That's right, and that turns up in the Born to Boogie documentary. Yeah. I watched that film recently, and that, the absolute highlight is a sort of rock and roll style jam with Ringo and Elton and Mark Bolan, and
there is a great appearance on Top of the Pops of T-Rex, and in the band playing is Elton.
Yes, so
that's a great clip as well. Okay, track three on the album is not only the highlight of the album, the highlight of Ringo's solo career. It's just a general musical highlight. It's the song Photograph.
Arguably the best solo single
of any Beatle. Yeah, it's just a beautiful song. It's like all the best music. It's sort of the way the light shines on it over the last 50 years, it changes its meaning, it changes its context. It's a great track. It's written by Ringo and George, and again, it's this dynamic of Ringo and George, you know, melodicism, melancholies, you know, maybe a little bit of Ringo, I hate to use the word simplicity, but you know, a very straightforward notion of what the lyric is about. It's very direct, and it goes back to about May 1971, so he's had it knocking around for a while.
This was written following Mick Jagger's wedding, apparently. So Ringo and Paul were amongst the people that were flown out to Mick's wedding in the south of France, and after the wedding was over, Paul flies home, Ringo charters a yacht and is joined by George and Maureen and Cilla Black, and they go for a little
surprise
they go for a little sail round the south of France and write this wonderful song.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's still I said good vibes between the whole dynamic of Ringo and his wife and George and his wife, and none of that madness has kicked in yet. The whole Jagger, Mick Jagger, Bianca Jagger wedding was just a total crazy. Like they bundled all these people on a private jet, like Ringo Paul and Ronnie Wood, who wasn't even in the Stones at the time. They just took them off to the south of France, and then they didn't know the legalities of how to get married, and it was just a total farce in a way.
Yeah, my favorite comment is from David Hepworth, who said the Jagger wedding was the shabbiest free-for-all in the history of both rock and marriage, and skin-crawlingly embarrassing for all the key participants. I mean, he doesn't hold back there, but if you've seen some of the footage of that, Jagger hadn't realized that the wedding had to be open to the public under French law, so suddenly there's a scrum of journalists and photographers. Bianca is spilling out of her dress as the photographers are taking photographs. Suddenly they realize they have to make a declaration of community property before the wedding, and Bianca not too happy that there isn't much community property that they both own.
Yes.
There were three best men, or at least three people laying claim to being the best man at the wedding. There was Bobby Keys, Keith Richards, French film director Roger Vadim. I mean, it was just a complete shambles. Ringo probably glad to get onto a boat with George and Maureen.
And before the Richard Perry recording, there was apparently a late 72 recording which George produced.
This is something I only heard of recently, and I've never heard it. If anybody out there has a copy,
that'd be illegal.
That would be illegal, but do get in touch and describe it to us via Twitter or Facebook.
And you listen to Photograph, and it's great to hear, you know, George coming in on harmony. Like it's that really distinctive Beatle harmony when you realize what's happening. Like when you hear John in the background of I'm the Greatest, and you hear George in the background of Photograph. You know, it's a thing, all right.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of focus put on the fact, how well John and Paul sing together, but George and Ringo have that a sensational blend. And the other thing I like about this is this song is the guitar work, the arrangement, the sort of what seems to be 12-string guitar. It's just a beautifully arranged track.
Yes.
How much of that is down to George and how much of that is down to Richard Perry, I don't know.
That's why the other person you have in the room is Jack Nietzsche, who's doing the orchestra and chorus.
Doing the string,
And he's good at doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there was a promo filmed for this at Tittenhurst Park as well, and that went out onto Top of the Pops. That's knocking around on the internet.
Yes. This is. I mean, I sort of in passing said, you know, this is the best solo Beatles single. I mean, I genuinely believe it's certainly up there. It's a fantastic song.
Well, it's very sweet, and it really summons up its tone very well of looking back and, you know, thinking about what it means. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of think about, you know, what Ringo is like, or the kind of emotions Ringo generates. And he does generate, if you think of his kind of morose, empathetic, kind of his walk along the towpath in A Hard Day's Night, that kind of thing that he manages to make us feel for him. This is kind of the musical equivalent of that.
Yes, I suppose it sort of sums Ringo's character up in one song.
Yeah, and it kind of takes another turn, you know, in November 2002 when he comes on at the Concert for George and sings it. That's a lump in the throat.
That is a lump in the throat moment. You know, what strikes me about Ringo's performance is he sings two songs. He sings Photograph and he sings Honey Don't.
Mm.
Everybody else sings a George Harrison song.
Yeah.
But Ringo is sort of sufficiently comfortable in his relationship with George that you know, he doesn't have to do that. He does a rockabilly song because George loved rockabilly, and then he sings this, which is a co-write.
Yes.
And, you know, this clip is available on YouTube, but he's performing this under a giant photograph of George Harrison taken around 1965, 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And he references the fact that this song has taken on different meaning.
Any chance you were at that gig, Stephen?
Yes, I'd forgotten. I'd forgotten that I was at that gig.
But obviously when you're at that gig and you know,
I was at that gig.
I know you were at that gig.
Yeah.
You've mentioned that once or twice. But Ringo comes out. Can I ask, like, did you have a sense that, oh, he's going to play Photograph? Or did you have any idea of what anyone was going to play on that night?
No. I mean, I genuinely had no idea. And it Ringo coming out, that was an absolute high point. And the opening sort of chords of Photograph, I mean, it was an incredibly emotional experience. Just the fact that Ringo was on the stage and then to be doing that song. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. And as you say, you realized, as soon as he started to play it, you realized that this was going to take on, as you say, a different meaning.
Absolutely.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So great song, Photograph. Track 4 on side 1 is Sunshine Life For Me, open bracket, Sail Away Raymond, close bracket. George Harrison written on his own. And it's an interesting song, written apparently, I didn't know this until you told me, written in Ireland.
Yes, and you say it was written by George, but Donovan was there.
All right, and it's a wonder he's not trying to FaceTime us right now to tell us his role in writing that song.
You know, I mean, I think Donovan, you know, big influence on the Beatles, helped them write a lot of things. Who can tell? But it was written in County Kildare.
Yes.
The timing was the Easter weekend in April 1971. And George says he wrote it like an old Irish folk song. I'm not sure I get the old Irish folk song.
It sounds more like that pirate song that he sings in Rutland Weekend TV. Yes. It's got that kind of hey ho and a nonny nonny kind of thing.
But the background, I mean, I the first time I heard this album, I just thought, oh, it's an interesting kind of twangy country song. And who is Raymond? But the Raymond was apparently a lawyer.
Yeah.
Let's hear it for the lawyers.
Hey.
He was their lawyer. He was the
client's lawyer for the three Beatles, well, wasn't he?
That's it. And in March of 71 was when the High Court ruled that, you know, they were going to appoint a receiver. So George very much had this on his mind, and Paddy Boyd has said this is what was going through his mind at the time, that he was very upset about the sort of the rying and the ill feeling, and his idea to sail away Raymond. You know, if we could get rid of the lawyers, the world would be a better place.
Well, he writes that song, as you say, Easter 71, and March 71 is when that court case kind of ends. You know, the first round of it ends in Paul's favour, saying the Beatles should go into receivership. And, you know, it's interesting, you kind of look at the you pick up a copy of Ringo and you look at the back and you say, oh, I wonder who's playing on that. And it's Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm, Rick Danko, Garth Hudson. It's four out of the five members of the band. Richard Manuel is elsewhere. And, you know, again, you're like, what a stellar lineup, you know? And the band are in Los Angeles at the time recording Moondog Matinee, which is another kind of rock and roll throwback kind of call.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's a sort of covers album. And this was taken very much at the time, you know, that the band were running a bit dry on the songwriting front, running out of inspiration.
Yeah.
And you can see that, you know, songs like Rag Mama Rag clearly have an influence on the style of this song and just the general feel of the song. The other person who's on the song is a guitar player called David Bromberg.
Oh, yeah.
Who worked with Bob Dylan back in the sort of New Morning era. And he and George around that time wrote a song called The Hold Up.
Okay.
Which it's not a song I had ever heard. George, I don't think, ever recorded it, but you can check that out on Spotify and YouTube.
It's interesting, you know, you think of Sunshine Life for Me, and, you know, you might think, okay, it's just it's not All Things Must Pass, but then you kind of tear into the lyrics a little bit, and it really is, again, it's almost like George's motto, where he sings, it's a sunshine life for me. If I could get away from this cloud over me, it seems to follow me around. That's a real George motto, almost, that he's trying to constantly get to some kind of point of peace, but he can't get away from the things that drag him down.
He's a great one for a cloud / rain metaphor.
Yes. George. Well, there's nothing wrong with weather metaphors in music. That's this week's Jeff Lynne mention. Anyway. So many songs about weather.
I feel I just set that up. I just walked straight into that.
And the other thing I noticed on this, maybe you don't know anything about this, is that the song is published by the Material World Charitable Foundation, which George had set up in 73.
Yes, yes.
So it's a charity song, isn't it, or something?
It's, well, no, what he did was he set up a charity to direct some of the songwriting royalties to good causes. Because that's the kind of guy he was.
He's a good man.
He is a good man.
Okay. So that leads us then to the end of side one, which is Your 16, which is the track we've already talked about before, the Nielsen rock and roll rave up. And that's the end of side one. Very tidy side one. All killer, no filler, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely.
You then flip over to the B-side. First track is Oh My My. Now, this ended up being the third single. I think this is probably my least favorite bit of the album, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not a song. It's not a song that I like particularly, but it was a top five hit in the US. And again, if you look at the roster of talent that Ringo was able to sort of draw, you know, we had the band, virtually all of the band on the previous track. The backing vocals here are Mary Clayton, who's worked with the Stones, and Martha Reeves, not the Vandellas, but Martha Reeves. So, you know, if you're Ringo, you can presumably just pick up the phone, get these people to turn up in the studio.
And Billy Preston is on piano and organ.
Yeah, But I agree with you. I don't. I think this is actually one of the weaker tracks. But what do I know? Top five hit.
Yeah. Well, then the second track on side two, I think, is kind of maybe the little hidden gem of the album, which is Step Lightly. Mm. Yes. And this is the only sole Ringo Starr writing credit on the album, so it's a pure Ringo original, and it is a little gem, you know. And Ringo's tap dancing on it as well.
It is, yeah. So he supposedly at the end of a session in London, he was slightly the worse for wear, sent his chauffeur out to buy some tap shoes, and just decided, yeah, what this needs is a tap solo. But it's very funny. It's very entertaining. And Ringo obviously likes it. He re-recorded the song on Ringo 2012.
Right. And it's interesting, this song and a couple of other songs, but this song in particular features Tom Scott arranging the clarinets. And Tom Scott's a fascinating guy. He's got this Zelig-like appearance where he pops up in lots of rock and roll history. So he plays the solo on Listen to What the Man Said. He pops up on things like Black Cow by Steely Dan, Rapture by Blondie. He comes up on one of Robbie Williams' standards albums. He was in the Blues Brothers band. He's a really interesting fellow.
Yeah, and at this time, he is just about to start working with Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
So the Court and Spark album, and then Tom Scott and the LA Express.
Yes.
Head off with Joni Mitchell to do a tour. I think the live album is called Miles of Isles. And when they are in London, George goes along to the Joni Mitchell concert and then invites everybody back to his house. And they form the nucleus of the band that recorded Dark Horse.
Interesting. And the other thing that, you know, worth mentioning about Tom Scott was that he was the band leader on the Chevy Chase show. Now, this is a bit of a... Have you ever seen any clips of the Chevy Chase show?
Clearly not.
In 1993, there was one of these Battle of Late Night Televisions in the US, and Chevy Chase was given a talk show on the Fox Network that lasted about 6 weeks. It went up against Dave Letterman's New Late Show. And it is one of the biggest catastrophes on television. You can dial it up on YouTube. Try and see how far you can get into the first episode without dying of just an absolute cringeworthy... You're watching it through your fingers. It is catastrophically bad television. But Tom Scott was the band leader on that show.
Who decided it would be a good idea to give Chevy Chase... there was a lot of cocaine in those days.
Well, you know, he kind of... I think people had thought, well, he'd been on Saturday Night Live back in the day and he'd told jokes and sat at a desk. But I swear to God, the Chevy Chase show, episode one is Goldie Hawn, and it's they decide at one point to just start dancing. And one of my favorite bits of the show is he comes out to the audience, and like all these shows, the audience are all clapping and everything else. And the set is all LA, and there's a basketball net, and somebody throws him a basketball, and he throws it at the basketball net and misses. And he keeps throwing the basketball into the net and keeps missing. And this is riveting television. It's just awful. But the Chevy Chase show from 1993, look that up on YouTube if you want to entertain yourself.
Or don't.
So that leads us to the next song, the third track on side two. Some might say it's the best song on the album. It's the track 6 o'clock, which is Paul's contribution. So it seems that Richard Perry and Ringo decamp at the end of March to the UK. And Ringo attends the premiere of a movie that he's starring in called That'll Be the Day in London on the 12th of April, and Paul and Linda are there. And then 4 days later, Ringo is recording this song in the Apple studio with Paul and Linda and Richard behind the desk.
Yeah, and the context for this is interesting because it's around this time, 31st of March, so just as literally as Ringo is touching down in the UK, Alan Klein's management contract expires with John, George and Ringo and is not renewed.
Yes.
So what's sort of significant is that McCartney has gone on record earlier in the year to say, oh, you know, we could record together again if Alan Klein is out of the picture. And suddenly Alan Klein is out of the picture.
Yes.
And a couple of days later, John is giving an interview in which he says, let's just say it's possible that Paul's suspicions were right. So suddenly there is again added impetus to this. Another obstacle is out of the way. We've had three Beatles recording in LA. Now two Beatles are recording in London. So that's the context for the sort of feeding frenzy that's going on around. They're going to reform.
But that's a reasonably understandable thing that you could take from all of that, because you think, you know, if you look at, as you say, March and April, the end of March, Alan Klein is legally officially out of the picture. George, Ringo and John are in no place to bring him back or to keep him involved at all. And, you know, you can say, well, look, yes, we've had this George, Ringo, John session. Klein is gone. Can we get Paul? Yes, we've got Paul. Two and two could easily make four in a, you know, when you're looking at that from the outside.
Absolutely. And again, the context of this is we just had the release of the Red album and the Blue album, the compilations. So they are sort of making their way to the top of the charts. They are, the Beatles are back in the charts. They're very visible. There's a growing interest again in the band. This is probably, the stars are sort of aligning at this point.
And you kind of think that, you know, if anyone, you know, it had been very definitely, you know, in the media and in, you know, in between themselves, it had been Paul versus the other three. And you look at 70, yep. 71, 72, you know, George is recording with John, he's in the Imagine film, you know, Ringo is recording on John's singles, you know, George and Ringo, as we said, have done a ton of work together. So there is a John, Ringo, George axis that's been going on 70 to 72, and Paul has been totally a man apart, and he's been, you know, getting some bad criticism in the press. He's trying to plow his own furrow. You know, it's interesting, you look at this album, and as you say, it features kind of the creme de la creme of LA sessioneers, but you know, that's not the world that Paul is moving in at the start of the 70s. He's making records in a very, very different way. And, you know, it's a big deal that this is kind of the first time you can draw a line between John Lennon and Paul McCartney in an artistic setting.
Yes, I mean, this is really Paul entering back into that circle to an extent. One of the fascinating things is that consistently later in his career, when Paul has a tour to promote or a product to sell, he would tap into the Beatle reunion rumor, and he would say, oh, well, you know, we might get together again, or we might do something. And this is something that George in particular was always sort of quite dismissive of, and saying, you know, if you want to see the Beatles, go and see Wings. So Paul, but what happens here is later in the year, in May, whenever Paul is pushing his tour, and he's really driving to get Wings established. You know, they've had a pretty shaky start. They've got Red Rose Speedway. They're just about to do Band on the Run. He's actually quite dismissive of what has happened in terms of the recording, and he's saying, oh, well, I would have done it for any friend.
Yeah.
So he almost is sort of downplaying this to the level of, well, you know, if anybody had phoned me up, you know, like if Mick had phoned me up, or I'm happy to go and play.
But he also says, when he's doing the James Paul McCartney TV special, he gives an interview and he says, well, there's no real reason why we shouldn't get together again once, you know, Alan Klein is gone. Like he's not totally locking that down.
Yeah, it's I'm interested to know what happened between him saying that, which was sort of in March or earlier in the year when they're doing that filming. And then a month afterwards, or 2 months afterwards, when he's promoting the tour, it's sort of being downplayed again. And he's clearly, I think, at that stage, Wings have not established themselves on a sound footing. And he seems to be wanting to shift the focus back to, well, this is what I'm doing now, and this is my band.
But it is very much so. This recording session in April of 6 o'clock, this is very much a reaction to the, you know, I'm the greatest, you know, the John, George and Ringo session, because Ringo apparently calls Paul up and says some version of, hey, you don't want to be left out of this, do you? And Paul says, okay, you know, let's do it. So he's not, you know, it would have been totally imaginable for him to say, no, listen, you just keep doing your own thing. I've got my own thing going on. But he does roll up his sleeves and he does this song. Do you like 6 o'clock?
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's not a highlight of the album. It's I think for me part of the problem is it's quite dated in the keyboard. The sort of synth sound is quite dated.
I think it sits apart from the rest of the album. It sounds of a different thing.
Yes. I mean, I think the other songs on the album have a sort of a general, as you say, that mood, that sort of nostalgic. This is sort of jarringly modern with the keyboard sound. It's that said, it's very much, you know, you've got the Paul and Linda vocal mix there. Particularly, there's a short version on the album, and then there's a slightly longer extended version, which is just Wings.
Yes. Well, it does have a sort of, you know, something we talk about a lot is the McGear album, but it has a certain kind of McGear vibe. It's just this early 70s pop McCartney, Linda singing with them. As you say, you know, there's this rock and roll feel to the rest of the album, whereas this does feel like what McCartney was doing contemporaneously. Yeah. And it's recorded in the UK. It's even though it's still produced by Richard Perry, but you look at the settings or the credits on the back, and it's like, okay, Paul's playing piano, Paul's playing the synthesizer. Oddly enough, Klaus Voormann is still on bass. You would have thought there was a bass player in the room. But it's got those Linda vocals, which are a very, you know, solo Beatle sound. I appreciate what you're saying about the synthesizer sounds of its time, but it's still got that classic kind of McCartney organization and structure where there's a synth and there's a string section and there's some flutes and there's some vocals and there's a melody line on top. It is a Paul jam.
It's a pop song.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I think the others, whether it's rock or rock and roll, the other songs on the album are sort of rock and roll songs. This is very clearly a pop song. As you say, it's got all of the hallmarks of a Paul McCartney, not even a Paul McCartney song, but a Paul McCartney production. I mean, if Richard Perry hadn't been there, I don't think this would have sounded very much different.
Yeah. And as you say, there is a the version on the album is about 4 minutes. There's a longer version that's about 5.5 minutes where it's just got one of those kind of McCartney improv codas at the end where you can just hear him kind of vamping and singing the riffs over again on the end of it. It does kind of get pointed out in certain reviews of the album that some say it has, you know, it doesn't really have the collaborative feeling of the other parts of the album in terms of collaborating with Ringo.
No, it has a certain slight charm, is how somebody put it. But my favorite comment on this is someone called Alan Betrock, I'm sure that's not a real name, of Phonograph Record, who wrote, "Paul McCartney, 6 o'clock would have been a perfect chart topper for himself and Wings, possibly rivaling Yesterday in worldwide stature."
I don't think so.
I think he's on his own there, I think.
I mean, you know, I'll wave a flag for McCartney. I don't think it's that good, but it is. No. It is one of those early 70s McCartney pop nuggets if you're into that kind of thing. Then next track, second last track on the album, is Devil Woman, and unfortunately this is not the Cliff Richard song from 1976.
I would love to hear Ringo
to Devil Woman. That is a great song, Cliff Richard.
It is a great song.
And again, this is fun. It's maybe a little bit slight, but it's just a rocker with kind of clunky Ringo-y lyrics on top.
Little bit raunchy lyrics for Ringo, but you know.
And it does have a Beatles allusion in it. It mentions Sexy Sadie in the lyric. So
it does,
yeah. Hold on. Do you want me to get out my lyric sheet in front of me and read it out?
Yeah, yeah.
The lyric is, where is it? "Every time I see you in the neighborhood, I say, you're the kind of woman that makes me feel good. I want to beat you up, and then I want to be kind. And one of these days, I'm going to make you mine. Sexy Sadie, you look like the devil to me. Devil woman, that's not the way it should be."
So, you'd never get away with that lyric today.
Jesus, it's just...
Well,
I wish I hadn't started when I was in the middle of reading that.
Do you want to go back and read something else?
No, let's leave it be.
Well, again, Sexy Sadie was around a lot because she pops up on a George Harrison song on Dark Horse.
Which one? Remind me now.
The rest is simply Shady. Says, you may think of Sexy Sadie, let her in through your front door.
Ah, well, there again, you know, it's just pressing the kind of the nostalgia, hey, remember the Beatles kind of buttons, you know, where people like you and me will go, hey, he mentioned the Beatles, that's my hometown. Yeah. and then we get to the end of the record, track 5, side 2. This record is only 37 minutes long. It's shorter than this podcast. And the last track on the album is You and Me, open brackets, Babe, close brackets, written by Harrison and good old Mal Evans.
I love this song.
Yeah.
I think this is a great song. And I like the idea that Mal was getting some royalties here. So Mal Evans is, you know, just a quick recap. He's the, was effectively one of their road managers in the early 60s. He was involved in Apple. he's now working. He discovered Badfinger, etc. So he's been kind of part of their inner circle for a long time. So he and Harrison are sharing a house in LA. He had the lyric. He asked Harrison, could he do something with it? And lo and behold, he gets a writing credit on one of the biggest albums of the year.
Yeah, and it's great. It's just another member of the old gang being pulled into the flow of this project,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot to like about this. George's guitar is so sweet on it. It's so nice. And he's not doing his 70s slide. He's playing just a really lovely melodic bit of guitar soloing all over it. It's great. And again, Nicky Hopkins is still on piano. It's Ringo on drums. And it's not Ringo and Jim Keltner. I'm always odd that there's a lot of songs that are credited to Ringo and Jim Keltner on drums.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is that really just Jim Keltner? I don't know. But this is just Ringo on drums, Klaus on bass, Nicky Hopkins, Tom Scott and Jack Nietzsche again arranging the backing to it. And it's an infectious kind of fun song.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous song. And, you know, you were saying back when we were talking about I'm the Greatest and the allusion to the Beatles, and you have a crowd noise in the background there. And again, you've got this is sort of completes the circle. This is him doing a sign off. And at the end of this, he actually sings about this being a record.
You know, yes, sings, this spoken word bit.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm here on this little bit of plastic that's spinning round and round, and I'd like to say thank you to everybody. And he very carefully, you know, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, he lists everybody, and suddenly the Beatles are all together again.
Yes, it really drives the point home about what this project is. Mm. And, you know, even that bit where he kind of refers to himself in the third person, your friend and mine, Ringo Starr, that's kind of how he signs off.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, something that, you know, you and me talk a bit about is that, you know, Ringo, he's really a fantastic musician and drummer, but unfortunately he sidles himself up to being more of this kind of entertainer, you know, this guy who gets up to sing a song type thing.
Yeah.
And I think this is the best capturing of this notion of Ringo as a friend, as an entertainer, as being all things to all people, you know, that kind of sign off where he's talking to us all. That's again, just essence of him.
It is. As I say, it sort of completes the concept of the album.
Yeah.
You really feel that you're sort of, you know, he's inviting you in. He's sort of making fun of himself. He's not taking anything too seriously. And then there's this very sort of warm sort of send off.
Yeah. And so that's the last track on the album. And, you know, there's some, you know, overdubs and arrangements and things that come on. We should also mention that, you know, Paul adds some overdubs to Your 16 as well. He plays the mouth sax solo.
There's a bit of dispute as to exactly what he's doing there. Is he playing a kazoo, or is he just a comb and paper, or is he just sort of
doing a Lady Madonna kind of job.
Doing a Lady Madonna kind of thing on it. But
this notion that the album represents, you know, if it is a concept album, that it represents kind of a showcase or a presentation of Ringo, then you can say that by looking at the cover, that really drives that notion home. So the cover art and the booklet that came with the original copies, that all fits in with all of this, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, it's an incredibly lavish cover and booklet, and, you know, your very detailed hand painted cover, which features a sort of, again, there's a little bit of a nod to Sergeant Pepper, where you've got a crowd scene, and they say, if you look, you've got Paul and Linda and George and John and Yoko are all in the crowd.
Yeah. The band are there.
You've got a booklet where Klaus Voormann has handwritten the lyrics out and done a little sort of lithograph to illustrate every single song. So this is an incredibly lavish.
Yeah, I've got my copy in front of me right now, which, Stephen, you'll recall, I bought for the princely sum of £1 in Belfast a number of years ago.
Definitely worth a pound.
Definitely worth a pound. An immaculate condition album where the man in the record store was like, oh, I don't know, I think it's a pound. But it's this gatefold sleeve, beautifully you know, these beautiful kind of stars all throughout the gatefold sleeve. And then this very detailed 12-inch booklet attached to the gatefold sleeve where Stephen says there's these Klaus Voormann drawings, one for each track, in and around all the specs for the album itself. It's a really lovely package. But it does add, as I said, to the concept of it, that this is a show, this is Ringo presenting himself, this is a, you know, a glorified version of himself.
And I think I'm right in saying, is there a reference on the back to the Jim Keltner fan club?
There is. There's a reference. If you go inside that lovely booklet, it says at the bottom, yeah, the Jim Keltner fan club, send a stamped, undressed envelope to 1750 North Vine Street, Hollywood, California, which I think is the Capitol building.
And it was it was Jim Keltner's address.
Oh, was it? Oh,
well, because I remember there was an interview with Jim Keltner where he says, yes, it was hilarious, except they actually used my address. And I was inundated with, letters and things. But that was a bit of a dig at Paul using that, because he had Paul had put on the back of a Wings album.
All right.
The Wings fan club send a stamped addressed envelope to, and gave the address. So Ringo sort of was sending that up, and I think it's on Living in the Material World. George does the same
by saying,
he says, send a stamped undressed elephant to and gives an address. So, you know,
it is all good fun. All good larks. And it's a good album. Then written across the top, there's the seemingly portentous Latin phrase written around an apple, dui en Monday, which is actually Pigeon Latin / French for do it on Monday, which is a Nielsenism.
It is.
More Nielsen.
And he used that as as the title of an album the next year or a couple of years.
He did, he did. The original title of, the reason he used that as a title was that that Nielsen album was originally supposed to be called God's Greatest Hits, and the label balked at the last minute. But I think God's Greatest Hits is a fantastic album title. I hope somebody's used it in the meantime.
When your first album comes out,
when I drop my surprise record, and then the final bit of design is that record label, because it's not a classic Apple record label.
No.
Do you want to describe it, or should we just let people find out? It's basically the little record label in the middle of the 12-inch record is a star shape of Ringo, and he's kind of, it's his head popping out from under a silk sheet in a star formation. And when you put the record on a spindle in your record player,
we see where you're going with this. We see where you're going.
The spindle sticks out. Do you know what I'm trying to point out? Okay,
yeah.
That's one last joke for all of us. So this album comes out, and it's preceded in September 73 by the Photograph single. The album comes out on November the 3rd. At the end of November, Photograph is number one. So this is a hit album, you know, and you look you look at the hits of 1973. So number one in the US in 1973, earlier in the year, you've already had number ones from George and Paul. So Paul's had My Love at number one in June. He's knocked off the number one spot by George saying, Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth. And now here in November 73, November 24th, for 1 week, you get Ringo Starr at number one with Photograph, and the album climbs up into the US top 10 as well. So it's a big smash hit record. There's no denying that.
No, and three singles. I think this is the record and the singles that prompted Lennon to say to Ringo, you know, any chance you could write me a hit? So, you know, he was at this point, he's outselling John Lennon.
Yeah, and Photograph is the first single. Your 16 comes out as the second single in December. That hits number one for a week at the end of January 74. And then Oh My My comes out in February 74. And that hits the top 10 as well. So
yeah,
two number ones and a top 10 hit,
he can do no wrong. I mean, 1973, I think, is really the absolute peak Ringo.
But a bit like the I'm the Greatest session, you know, where you think, oh, this is the start of something new, and it actually turns out to be the end of something.
Mm.
Is the Ringo album also the end of something? I mean, it never gets as good again, really, does it?
I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
And it hasn't, its reputation hasn't aged well. You know, to have been a number one album and had those singles, it's almost part of that pre-Last Waltz,
you know,
where you've got all of these superstars. You could just get, if you want to get Martha Reeves in, you get Martha Reeves in. If you want Mark Bolan, you get Mark Bolan. And it's, there's something about that whole early 70s LA scene, which is just about to be swept away. So it's a high point of that, and it's also a high point, as you say, you're not going to get this level of collaboration across all four Beatles. Again, Ringo's not going to have commercial success on this scale.
Yeah.
Again, you know, when you've reached the top, there's only one way to go.
Well, you could argue, yeah, and you could, you know, if you're being a bit cruel, you could say, well, you know, he delivers this great album, and I still enjoy it. I think it's great fun, but you kind of think, well, you know, this might be all the Ringo I need. I'm like, there isn't really anything else that he can do. This is the best version of that thing he does, is this album.
I think so. I think that's right. I mean, if you only had to buy one album, Ringo album, this would be it. But, you know, it's a great album.
Oh, it is a great album. Now, there's one or two things you could say that, you know, perhaps would have helped. Obviously, Ringo didn't tour, you know, so in terms of promoting the album, he's got these three hit singles, but it was never really an option that there was going to be a Ringo Starr world tour or anything of that kind. He doesn't tour until the end of the 80s when the All-Star Band comes into play. So that kind of leaves him adrift in terms of trying to be creative or trying to keep a momentum going, you could say.
I think so. He sort of tries to replicate the formula on the next album, which is Goodnight Vienna.
Yeah.
And it's a good album. But there's an increasing sort of diminishing return as we go on. He had appeared at Bangladesh, so he'd done his little solo spot there. There is a very strong rumor circulating in early 74 that he's going to tour with George.
Oh, right.
That there's going to be that Dark Horse tour of America is going to be a joint George and Ringo tour. Around this time, George and Ringo were looking at buying Apple, sort of buying the other two out and thinking, well, this would be a good vehicle. So it's also probably the height of their relationship.
Yeah.
Artistic collaboration. But yes, this is it's the absolute peak of something. But I think you're right. It's also the start of the end of something as well.
But there's probably one other thing, and we've talked about this before, which is the notion that, okay, the album isn't out of print, but there probably is a little bit of work that needs to be done on Ringo's back catalogue. You know, that there's a market there for some kind of, you know, Ringo Starr, the Apple albums, where you take Boku of Blues, Sentimental Journey, Ringo, and Goodnight Vienna, and a fifth CD of, you know, bonus tracks or some sessions, yeah, and all the rest. Package that up and say, look, this is a nice little body of work. It's reflective of the time. This was what the drummer in the Beatles did next.
Yes, I mean, I think so. I mean, you know, we have a reissue of the Ringo album has come out. I think Goodnight Vienna came out as well. And but yes, I, you know, an Apple Ringo the Apple Years a box set, I'd buy that.
Well, yeah, but you'd buy anything, wouldn't you? No,
that's pretty much true.
All right. Well, look, that is the Ringo album, a little time capsule from November 1973 from Ringo Starr. Like many of the things we do here, hopefully this will send you back to the record and give a listen to it with fresh ears. It is a little bottle of joy, and it's a super album and maybe worthy of a little bit more love and attention, but you know, maybe that's all the Ringo you need. So that's it from this time around. We are available in all the usual places. We are on Twitter at BeatlesPod. There's the Facebook group, which Stephen looks after. You can go along there. If you enjoy the show, make sure you're subscribed. Wherever you listen to your podcasts, please leave us a nice review. For now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.